I'm delighted today to be able to present my friend Maizhang Vu, who will be presenting on Wisconsin Hmong 101. I first met Maizhang in 1997 when we were both hired to do research in cultural traditions of Wisconsin in preparation for the state's sesquicentennial celebration at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. Maizhang herself presented there as a performer of katsiya, an improvisational poetry song tradition, as well as presenting and translating for other Hmong tradition practitioners that she had recruited. Born in wartime Laos, Maizhang left there with her family for Thailand in 1975 when the communists took over the government. In 1980, she came to the US, first to Illinois, and then, lucky us, to Wisconsin. That is when her path of advocacy began. She has been a tireless advocate for the impoverished for the past four decades, especially for Hmong people and refugees. She began this path in the 1980s by advocating for her family, extended family, and then the Hmong community. Maizhang's advocacy and grassroots activism led to the development of Hmong and refugee women nonprofit agencies in Wisconsin and Georgia. Her extraordinary leadership skills have been recognized through awards, national board memberships, including her presidency of Hmong National Development, and being a delegate on multiple international missions. I just want to say, she's a mover and shaker. I called her last month to ask her a question about today, and she was at Vice President Kamala Harris's reception for Asian American and Pacific Islander Month. Maizhang has a master's degree from UW-Madison. She is the author of Hmong in Wisconsin, a book she'll talk about or mention later, and that's published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. She worked for decades as the outreach coordinator for underserved populations at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, retiring recently in 2023, but retired in order to become the COO of the Hmong Institute, an agency that she founded in Madison with her husband, Xiaopeng He, whose name might be familiar as a recent candidate for lieutenant governor. The Hmong Institute works to empower community through education, health, and the preservation of Hmong heritage. I'm proud to sit on its board of directors and delighted that Maizhang is here with us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me today. And as we were coming, I was just sharing and that I talk a lot and there's a lot to say. And so my challenge today would be sharing as much as I can within the time that we have together. Today, what I would do is just share with you a little bit about my journey and the Hmong in Wisconsin. Many of you probably know our relationship with the United States is through the secret war in the Vietnam War. And today I'm not going to talk about the history, but I just want to mention that in case some of you may not know. The covert operation in Laos with the CIA is a very complex secret war where many of you in the United States were not aware of it until years later, and the promise made to our Hmong veterans is that the American would take care of them should the war is not won. And so in 1975, when the American withdrew its troop, the Hmong genocide began. And that's how many of us journey to survive. And we come as refugees, not immigrants. Many people may not know the differences. Where for an immigrant, you plan where you go, and you go because you seek opportunity for better life. For refugees, you don't know where you're going. You don't know who's waiting for you on the other line. When I do culture training, people always ask me, why come to Wisconsin, not California? And I always say, only if we knew that California is the weather like our country, we all would go to California. So as refugees, we don't know who's waiting for us. We don't know where we're going. We just leave overnight to survive so we don't get killed. And so I can tell you lots of wonderful refugee stories, but that will save for another day. Wisconsin in the United States is the third largest of Hmong population, in case you don't know. We are close to 60,000 by census data. However, we think that there's many more than what the census say. And unlike the Twin City, if you know where they're the second largest in the United States, the cluster in the Twin Cities. Here in Wisconsin, we are scattered throughout 15 counties. So you find, I say poor little Sheboygan, such a small town, but the ratio of Hmong in Sheboygan is a lot larger than what we say Wausau would be, right? And so we have different experiences in Wisconsin depending on how we embrace our neighbor and how our neighbors embrace us, right? So Wausau, for example, have gotten a lot of the racial tension where the school bus system many, many years ago, you know, brought national attention to that. And so that's how they continue to have more sharing of the Hmong experiences in Wausau. So anyway, that's in a nutshell about the Hmong in Wisconsin. What I will do is just, share a little bit about my journey. Growing up in the refugee camp, I grew up there about 5 years. And as children, you don't have much to do your role of the day, because I have a lot of older siblings. So they do everything. My role, just go get water. And when I fill up the bucket, the tank in our house, and when I go and finish my watering the garden, I'm free to, wander around the camp, whatever I can do to entertain myself, right? So as children, one of the highlights in the camp is finish your chore and go find this monstrous-looking guy. He's tall, and we're all kids, so we're down to his waist. And it's not hard to find him because, you know, he's so monstrous-looking. He's always dragging a crowd of children who don't have enough look of him. So every time when I joined the crowd, I would navigate my way to get close to him, and I would look up to him like this, and I would study his face, and I would say, oh my God, his eyes are blue like the sky, his nose is as big as my dad's pipe, and his ear perk up like mushrooms. Who is he? Why is he such a monster looking, right? And then I have enough look of him, and I would run back home, and I would ask the question to my mom and dad, who is this monstrous looking guy? And the answer is always, he's an American, an American. So for years, I developed this mentality of images of who the American people are, right? In February 1980, when we are about to land in Chicago, the country is nothing but pure white. I looked, I study, and I was so happy I had my answer. I turned to my brother, who speaks some English, and I said, now I understand why the American people are so white, because they're from a white country. So that, personal bias of who the American people are. When we landed, our sponsor who sponsored us just looked like that gentleman, tall, blonde, blue eye. And then when we moved to Wisconsin and started to live, then, the question of American history comes in, like, when they don't all look like that person. It's like, now, who are you? You don't look like him. Now, who are you? You're short. You don't look at him. And so that began my own learning of the American history. And I tell this story a lot of the time because it's your own personal bias. When you don't have enough knowledge, you can paint a picture that's very different than reality, right? So coming into the United States, as a young teenager, it's good that I have parents who are very proactive. My father is a great, by Hmong standards, community leader in Laos, and he's also a leader in the war and so forth. So they are very proactive in making sure that we survive. and that we don't become a liability to the government. And so education is always the number one key. My dad, every year during Christmas time when everybody get together, he doesn't have anything else to say to us but one piece of advice. I brought you here. School is at your doorstep. If you don't study hard, it's not my fault. Some younger sibling, you know, they didn't understand that phrase at the time, but over the years, you know, he repeated enough that they understand that, okay, they have to work hard. So that's my father. He's very proactive in making sure that we know who we are and that we behave and all of that so he doesn't lose reputation, right? Because he's a clan leader where nationwide people sought for his advice. And every day our houses fill with people coming in so he can deal with their disputes. And the last thing he wants is naughty kids who bring shame to him. So he's always making sure that we discipline. My mom on the other side, moving forward, don't think about the past. Don't have time to grieve. Don't have time to, you know, be sad. So she's always learning, modeling education for us. Making sure that we do and we value education. So this is my mom's motivation, that when you look at her, you go, this old lady, if she's that motivated, we should do better than her. And that is, she would ride the bus from Kakana to Appleton so she can sit with a Caucasian person and say, hello, my name is, and, you know, develop an opportunity to speak English. Or she would go to the thrift store and, you know, look at it, and then the cashier, the clerk will come and say, may I help you? And then she'll have a conversation. That's how hard she learned English, finding ways to do it. And so when we look at her, we're like, oh my God, if she's so that motivated, it would be a shame if we don't study hard, right? So then that moves us. So the parents are very important, and I'm very thankful that I have the eggshell that protects the little yolk so that the little yolk can grow into its own chicken and break apart and be its individual. So I'm thankful for my parents. When we come in, we also have a lot of things that we don't know. How many of you gone to a place where you're the minority and you don't know anything about it? Yeah. That feeling is sometimes frightening, anxious, you're curious, and all of that. So, and culture shocks. So as a teen, almost a teen when I arrived, school was about to end. They say, we'll wait to put you to school in the fall. And so when I went to high school, there were just so many things that I did not know, that's shocking to me, and I don't know how to focus in school because of so many culture shocks, and that has to do with physical appearance as well as food and, you know, all of that. So my favorite story to tell about culture shock is in gym. How many of you grew up in a time where you have to take shower? I don't think anyone likes it, but because school does it, so then you have to do it, right? Well, we did not know anything about it because we didn't speak English, so we were just going the flow. And my sister and I went to gym. It was volleyball. We wore a uniform. And as we were heading to the locker, our, you know, peer students just ran into the locker and started stripping their clothes off. And by the time we reach our locker, they're all naked. And we're like, oh my God, these boobs are like, you know, papaya size. We're like, oh my God. Don't touch me, don't touch me. And so we're just like, slowly get to our locker, change our clothes, disappear from school. Because that psychological feeling of, oh my God, I'm going to school, I have to go to gym, you know. And so after months of trying to figure out why we don't go to school, our principal made an excuse that we don't have to take shower. We can go to the gym, but don't have to take shower. So there's, you know, a lot of these things where you don't understand the system, you don't understand the structure, and you just have to be part of it, but then you don't understand. And so it was hard. very hard. Language, it's also something that we all have to learn, right? And language is so different. In English, man, there's so many exceptions to the rules. Every time when I think, I got it, Mrs. Zimmerman would say, that's another exception to the rule. What? And so the meaning of the words, just like in Hmong, sometimes has multiple meanings, right? And that can also scare you as well as confuse you, right? A friend of mine, Dr. Dia Cha, who used to teach at St. Cloud, shared her story, and I tell her story all the time because I think it's so classic. When she was growing up in Colorado as a teenager, like me, she couldn't understand why American people want to sell their garage or their yard. She's like, so you go and you buy people's yard, how do you transport it? And then when you get it, how do you put it on? Because you already have a yard, and same thing with the garage. You already have a garage, so if you go, how do you transport it? And when you come back, do you put it next to your garage? Or what do you do? So one day her American mentor came along, and she said, yeah, would you like to go with me to a garage sale? And she jumped up with excitement because she was so curious. And then when they got to the garage sale, she said, why don't you people just say the stuff in the garage is what you want to sell? It's the stuff in the yard that you want to sell. Why do you not say that? You confuse people like us, you know. So language is very complex. And these are funny and things like that. But then there are also very fearful stories. So my first job with the state was part of my job is to develop a women's program. Because when the Hmong came to Wisconsin, all the men were, you know, trained to go to work, they go to work, and we have large family, we live together, we're still depending on public assistance. So then there's a program that was focused on subsidized job called Key State Initiative, where you would give special training to the women, like sewing, and then get them to employ at an agency, like Sheboygan, for example, at the Mills company. They sold socks, so Hmong women, perfect for them, right? Anyway, long story short, women on the workforce, men in the workforce, there's so much role reversal happening. And so forth. So anyway, so one of the women in our women's conference sharing her personal story, and she was sharing about her driving. So like my mom and dad, a lot of Hmong women move forward and be the best case manager there is for their parent, for their kids, right? While the men are still mourning and trying to grieve and all of that. So she could drive and her husband couldn't drive. So the big General Vang Pao was in town. They're holding a meeting in De Pere. And so she drove her husband, and they were on Highway 41 from Appleton to De Pere. And they were running late, so the husband kept pressuring her, go faster, go faster, go faster. So she sped up, and then the state patrol came, you know, put the siren light on. She go, oh, she didn't stop. Because she was afraid, right? And then they kept going, and then now the state patrol came next to her in the second lane, rolled his window and put the blow horn on and say, pull your car over the shoulder. Well, all she could understand is car over shoulder. And so she got even more scared. So now she's like holding her, you know, steering wheel really tight, really nervous, and say, how am I going to put this huge car on my shoulder? So she got so afraid, so she just kept going. And finally, the state patrol went in front of her and forced her to stop. So the story is, language is, you know, very complex, many exceptions to the rule, and many meanings, right? And so when you don't know and you're learning, it's very, very tricky. Anyway, I can tell all of these stories, but let's move on. Cheese. Oh, I have a cheese story, but we'll move on. education become, you know, very important for many of us, whether you're young or old, because you know that you're in Wisconsin as a new life, so you have to learn. So many of us are really busy chasing the American dream, going to school, working, and in our era, many of us are graduating from college because our parents, how many of you go to the farmer's market and get Hmong produce? You're supporting us because our parents are making extra money so can save for our college education. As Anne said, I formally retired, so now I can be free and do the work that I love without the bureaucratic headaches. And I developed all the things that I do because I was a teenager. I started as an interpreter, right, for my mom and dad, taking them to the doctor. And then I do it for my relative, and then soon I do it for the community. And then when I do all that, I saw all the, you know, language challenges. So then I become an advocate for the community. And then as I become an advocate, I understand that the system don't understand us, right? So I have to now be the bridge, the culture broker that goes on both sides. For example, my boss at the state, we fund nonprofit agency that's run by Hmong agency called MAA. It's called Mutual Assistance Association. And one time, my boss, we were going to meet with the MAA directors. It's on the weekend, so she was dressing down. She didn't want to offend anyone. So she was in jean and t-shirt. And I said to her, Sue, you might want to change, because if you go like that, you'd be insulting the director on the ground, because they would think that you are not respecting them enough. That's why you don't dress up. And they would be waiting for you in three-piece suits. You know, so culture brokerage, you know, it's very important, the work that I do, because I don't want the Hmong community to be upset and feel, you know, let down. On the other hand, I want to make sure that our system understands their needs, right? And so that piece become part of my life. So grassroots organizer has become part of my life, and I'm very happy that I am, you know, privileged enough to do that. Next. See, this is that challenge that I'm not doing very good because there's so much to share. So, okay, so about the Hmong Institute, you have the flyer, so you can read up more about it, but we have, you know, a big mission to empower the community through education, health, and so forth. And our work is about education prevention, direct services, and research. So a lot of the photo you see is from our direct services, but our education, but we also do research starting too. Okay, next. So a lot of the work that we do, you know, when we do direct services is all about social justice as well, right? In the refugee resettlement, people check off on their book as sponsor that they gave us food, but when they went home, we're really hungry because our main staple is rice. And when they give us only potato, doesn't fulfill us, right? So social justice, culture relevant food is so important in the work that we do. And we do it through a lot of volunteer as well. Next. We are so dedicated to our seniors who are, again, making a lot of sacrifices during the war. And now at their, you know, last stage in life, they look out the window and they have no places to go. So at the Hmong Institute, we have a daytime senior program where they come in together. They provide support for them. They be together. And they're not only Hmong, but they're small, Nepali, Laotian, and so forth. Next. And at the Hmong Kashir program, which is our senior program, we are their hope, we are their care, and we are everything for them. They look forward to come there every day. We try to teach them new things in the community, like celebrating birthday, going bowling, Halloween, you know, our latest is sports, teaching them how to play pickleball. birthday is something that they look forward to because we don't celebrate birthday, and so something new for them, make them feel important. Okay, next. We also do monthly field trips. We take them on to places that they haven't been to. Bowling is one of their favorite. And we took them recently to House on the Rock, and they were just amazed by how that house is sitting on the rock. Next. We also do a lot of, you know, youth programming too, because many people don't know, but the Hmong community is a very young community. 50% of our population is under the age of 18. So if we don't do our work, we know the impact they will have on community, right? So we have a Hmong Day at the state capitol, teaching them about state government, teaching them about civic participation, teaching them about the law. If you behave this way, this is where you land. If you behave the other way, this is where you go. Next. We also have a youth program called Hmong Language and Culture Enrichment Program in the summer for 5 weeks every summer. And, you know, a lot of things that people don't know is that prevention is cheaper than intervention. From my work over the years with the state government, when you put investment up front so the child has a good behavior, they don't go to the DOC hand of it, it's cheaper, right, than when they go over there and then you're trying to do work with them. So we took pride in making sure that our young community landed on the positive side and contribute to society on the proactive side. Next. The other thing that we are, you know, battling is race discrimination. When it happens to the individual, we don't know about it, but when it happened on the structure, like Hmong funeral, for example, when we practice Hmong funeral, traditionally, a lot of attraction on the participant number, the food, and the crowd forces the funeral director to not rent for us. So now in Madison, we have to go all the way to Oregon if we're practicing traditional funerals. And a lot of that is impacting our Hmong veterans. You know, they were recruited, and now they felt cheated. Like, when we were asked to help the American, they didn't ask for our citizenship. But now, how come we have to be a citizen to be recognized as a veteran in order to get veterans' benefits, right? And so that piece, we continue to fight. Finally, the governor has a proclamation to recognize Hmong veterans that on May 14th is Hmong Veterans Day, which is a good start, but still it hasn't addressed the social injustice issue. Next. And the latest one is, you know, for almost 50 years, the Hmong finally have relevancy in state government when that Bill 232 was passed to amend Hmong history to be taught in all schools last April. So for the first time, a lot of things have been happening, and that has been achieved. But it's without teeth. We all know when legislation passed without money, not much can be done, right? But it's a good start. Next. So I know I ran out of time, and we'll give you time for questions. But if you are, you know, interested in helping us, what can you do? You could do a, you know, few different things. Our 50-year anniversary is coming up next May, and we are doing a diaspora banquet, so keep that date in mind and come join us or be a sponsor. Ways that you can support us is, be our ambassador, talk about the work that we do, come volunteer, donate. We are very fortunate we have a few angels who now put us in the, you know, investment plan, and every year they gave us some stocks. So, you know, many people can also do that. I brought with me today a book that I wrote.
I have a copy.
Oh, you have it? Okay. It's called The Hmong in Wisconsin for Historical Society. So you want to take the book for $20 donation to the Hmong Institute. come see me afterward. All right, and thank you. I know time is short, but I'm open to some questions. You have time.
So I got to do this little intro, okay. And then we'll do the. That was lovely.
Minimum, that could be a 3 days conference. I know I got 2 minutes. It's just so hard. I think depending on which lens you come from. If you come from the lens of the Hmong people, they would feel that the Americans are not living up to this standard because, A, you know, when we were in the refugee camp and they were resettling Hmong and Laotian and Vietnamese would come, guess what? They didn't want to accept the Hmong. They said the Hmong were too primitive. They won't survive in this industrial country. So we have to go through another round of advocacy and so forth. So the first wave of Hmong coming to the United States were guinea pigs. They come in, the next day they go to work, they don't accept any penny from the government to prove that the Hmong can survive in this country. So from the Hmong's lens of it, the American government didn't live up to their standard. On the government side, I work for the government and I understand that they do what they can. Sometimes if they don't have enough knowledge, then they don't do a good job. And that comes with, when the Hmong came to this country, at least they could announce and say, welcome to our allies who helped us, right? They resettled us very secretly through sponsorship. Our neighbor didn't know why we were here. It's the veterans who have to do the education over and over, over again to introduce why we came to the United States. And so there's a lot to be done. And I understand, you know, the bureaucratic headaches and challenges within the policy, but if you have a will, there's a way, right? And over the years, although there's huge challenges, we do have very dedicated people on the local level that help embrace the Hmong by teaching their local government about who it is. So, for example, you know, in Wausau, Phyllis Birmingham is a super wonderful individual who dedicated her life in advocating for policy changes for the Hmong. You know, so there are a handful of people who understand the human nature of the issue and who stood up and do that. So, in general, yes, so if you have those beautiful big quilt of Hmong story cloth, hang on to them because that art is dying. It was done in the refugee camp for keeping our parents' insanity so they don't go crazy. So they're killing time doing story cloth. And then soon they learn that that story cloth can also be sent overseas and bring in money for them to feed the family. So that's where the huge generation of story cloth came from. And hang on to it because, again, we don't do them anymore. They're dying, and it's a dying art. So if you have them, instead of taking them to Goodwill, bring it to the Hmong Institute so we can have, you know, piece of our history. It's a dying art, so that's why at the Hmong Institute, a part of our heritage effort is teaching the needlework and all of that to the young students that come through our program. Thank you. Thank you all for your time. I really enjoyed it, and have a good day.